Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 510, titled Deadly Echoes, I Told You So, Part 2, being recorded on May 8th of the year 2005. What we're doing is we're going back in time to For the Record 248, recorded on Labor Day weekend of 2000, specifically September 4th of 2000. That was the kickoff, the official kickoff of the 2000 presidential campaign, and we're taking a look at some material that I presented originally in For the Record Program 248, titled Bush, the Political Heritage of George W. That broadcast, in turn, accessed material from other For the Record shows, and the concept underlying the program was that the people around George Bush, that is to say George the Younger when he was running in 2000, were people who had served his father. And so it appeared that basically what we're going to be seeing is a carrying on of what we had seen under the elder George Bush. What I did in For the Record 248 was to take a look at the heritage, the political heritage of the Bush family and the various things they'd done, and on the basis of that to foreshadow what I felt we would be seeing under Bush 2. What we're going to do next is to listen to a segment of For the Record 214, in turn excerpted into For the Record 248, and we're going to take a look at material from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. When the elder George Bush was head of the CIA, one of the very last things his agency did, or the agency did under his supervision, was to submit a report to then-President Jimmy Carter, which suggested that the world was running out of oil, and that specifically the Soviet Union was running out of oil, that they were very likely to make a move on the Middle East. They would invade the Middle East. This resulted in several things. First of all, the prediction of a phony oil shortage was combined with deliberate restriction of oil supplies by both Saudi Arabia and the major oil companies. This created an enormous increase in the price of gasoline, which destabilized the Carter administration. In turn, this forecast, totally phony as it says, it turns out, of an impending oil shortage disaster and a Soviet invasion of the Middle East, was used by the Reagan administration, the Reagan-Bush administration, to justify an enormous military buildup combined with tax cuts that led to enormous record deficits and a drastic increase in the U.S. national debt. Now, once again, under George the Younger, we are seeing an enormous increase in the price of petroleum. Surprise, surprise, something that benefits the major oil companies as well as the Saudis, the other oil-producing nations, and derivative elements like the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamo-Fascist organization. And once again, the military buildup of George Bush combined with tax cut is leading to record deficits. So let's go back to September 4th of 2000, and we're going to take a look at what I had forecast or foreshadowed for a second Bush, for an administration led by Bush 2. The George Bush CIA Saudi Arabian petroleum industry collaboration, described by Loftus and Ahrens as follows. This, by the way, from For the Record Program number 214, entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 2. And remember that when a George Bush was running for vice president in 1980, oil prices shot up. We now have George W. running for president in the year 2000. Look what's happening to oil prices. Even before Americans voted for Carter, the oil industry had launched a quiet crusade of its own in anticipation of a Democratic victory. In the last months of the Ford administration, the CIA had developed a series of papers on energy and oil issues. Just after his victory in November of 1976, Carter was shown a classified CIA analysis of global oil supplies. The old spies, unquote, we asked about this point, insist that the report had a powerful impact on Carter and helped to define his policies on the, quote, energy crisis, unquote. When Carter launched his National Energy Plan in April of 1977, he confirmed that the CIA had provided him with intelligence assessments which made dire predictions about future energy supplies in the Soviet Union. The CIA warning made front-page news. Quote, Russia would be importing oil from the Middle East by 1985, unquote. The Soviets would need to buy 3.5 million barrels per day, to be precise, whereas in 1977, they actually exported 1.5 million barrels daily. Quote, previously,
The assumption had been that the Soviets would continue to be self-sufficient in meeting their oil and gas needs, unquote. In order to bolster his energy crusade, unquote, the president was using the CIA to whip up a public frenzy about a looming conflict in the Middle East between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Associated Press ominously reported that, quote, in a few years, the USSR will face an energy crisis that is likely to sharpen U.S.-Soviet rivalries in the Middle East, CIA analysts predict. In effect, the CIA was telling President Carter that the Soviet Union would face a domestic oil shortage in 1985, causing the worst energy crisis in American history. When the Soviets ran out of domestic oil supplies, they probably would look to the traditional oil suppliers of the United States, especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Our sources in the intelligence community say that the CIA's oil shortfall, unquote, probably was the greatest intelligence fraud in American history. James Jesus Angleton would have been envious. His vessel fraud had hidden one tiny corner of Allen Dulles's covert operations, but in the long run, the forgeries he passed to Presidents Roosevelt and Truman only had limited foreign policy effects. This refers to Angleton's forgery of some communications allegedly intercepted from the Vatican. Continuing, that's the reference to the vessel fraud. Continuing here. The oil fraud of the 1970s succeeded in getting the U.S. president to change his policy toward Israel and the Arabs completely and directly promoted the massive defense expenditures of the 1980s, all based on the false premise that the Soviets needed oil and were planning to invade the Middle East. Some of the former intelligence officers we spoke to were adamant that the CIA was not to blame. They claim that CIA contacts in the oil industry cooked the books on the Soviet shortage by feeding misleading data to the CIA. Quote, the agency had grown fat and lazy in the Middle East, explained one of our sources. Again quoting, the oil companies were a big retirement area for ex-CIA staff. There were so many ex-CIA working for the oil companies that it was easy to fake the data, unquote. Of course, ex-CIA is a term that should be taken with a generous dose of salt. Note also here that Jimmy Carter made a bargain with the devil, although he believed the CIA assessment and was sincerely deceived. Ultimately, his conservation policies were sabotaged, and Jimmy Carter himself was destabilized by, among other things, the inflation that helped to push him out of office and Ronald Reagan and George Bush in. Note that as we continue. Others in the intelligence community say that it was not the underlying data that were bad as much as the analysis that was skewed back at headquarters. Quote, you have to understand who was screwing the Jews, unquote, one old spy told us. By the way, this refers to the petroleum industry's longstanding anti-Israel policy underlying the official pro-U.S. policy of the United States. Continuing, underlying and in contrast with, I should say, continuing, quote, the whole phony scheme, the oil shortages, the predictions about Soviet troops in the Middle East, the Saudi arms buildup, all of that crap started coming out of the agency back in 76. The CIA told their boss what he wanted to hear, and in those days, the head of the CIA was an oil man. That, of course, was George Bush. Continuing, perhaps the truth was somewhere in between. The CIA field agent slanted the data a bit to suit the oil industry, and the analysis exaggerated a bit more, and the analysts exaggerated a bit more. According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture phony CIA estimates and push them on Carter began in the last days of Gerald Ford's term. They claim that a cabal within the CIA realized that Carter would be the new president, produced the first phony report, and then promptly gave it to Carter as soon as he won, knowing how it would affect his view of the energy crisis. It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter. And that, again, from For the Record program number 214, bear in mind that the chain of events set in motion by those phony oil reports ultimately led to the, well, one could not say the bankrupting of the United States, but the tripling of the national debt in 8 years. And it then went over $4 trillion under George Bush.
That material again coming from For the Record 214, Trouble on Oil Waters Part 2. It was excerpted there in For the Record 248 from September 4th of 2000, and in turn, the material is taken from the text of The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Now, here in the year 2005, once again, we are seeing an enormous increase in gasoline prices. Once again, an enormous Bush administration military buildup combined with drastic tax cuts is leading to overwhelming budget deficits and a huge ballooning of the national debt. Now, one of the things that is being used to justify the enormous increase in petroleum prices is the concept of peak oil. This is something that was first presented by a group of petroleum industry analysts who forecast that world oil production would peak in the year 2000. One of the sticking points about this is the fact that these analysts are not mavericks or outsiders. Rather, these are people who are at the very epicenter of the petroleum industry, and perhaps the most notable of these is a fellow named Matthew Simmons. Matthew Simmons is himself an oil multimillionaire. He also is the number one energy policy advisor to the Bush-Cheney administration. I should add very quickly that I am two thumbs down on fossil fuels. To the extent that we can develop alternative energy sources, we should definitely do it. If I were an octopus, I'd be giving eight tentacles down. So the whole peak oil scam, and I believe that's what it is, frankly, could have a very positive side to it if, and it's a big if the American people pull their heads out of where they've got them right now and grow up with regard to using fossil fuels. If the American people and people around the world develop serious alternative energy sources, the peak oil, I believe, scam could have a positive aspect to it. The problem with the peak oil controversy is that it comes from the very elements that stand the most to gain from a permanent drastic increase in the price of petroleum. The epicenter of the peak oil concept comes from an organization formerly named Petro Consultants, later HIS Energy Group, or HIS Consulting Group. That is a wholly owned subsidiary of Thyssen-Bornemisza Industries, and the Thyssen Industrial Empire was not only one of the foundations of the Third Reich, they were very, very closely involved with the Bush family and their Bush family's business partners and protectors, the Harrimans. And as we've seen in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record programs 273 and 370, the Thyssen Empire was also one of the pivot points of the post-war underground Bormann capital organization, basically a Third Reich that went underground after World War II. The Petro Consultants, later HIS Group, is an analytical group which in turn collates data given to them by the petroleum industry. I'm not necessarily implying that the people in HIS, nay, Petro Consultants, are cynics, but rather the information that they are given to work with, their tools, their raw materials, so to speak, from an intellectual analytical standpoint, come from the petroleum industry itself, sources like Schlumberger, Halliburton, and others. So the concept of peak oil is rather like setting up the foxes to analyze the hen house, and then when the foxes, after much labor, analyze the hen house and conclude that we are running out of chickens and that we've hit the age of peak poultry. That's basically what I believe we are seeing. And one of the things that was so interesting is that all of a sudden prices began to go up in 2000 as another George Bush was on the Republican presidential ticket. And it was just a little bit too sudden for my taste. But also, again, note the fact that the epicenter of the peak oil advocacy is HIS, and that is a wholly owned subsidiary of Thyssen-Bornemisza Industries. What we're going to do now is once again to jump back to For the Record 248 from September 4th of 2000, and once again we're going to excerpt material from the Loftus Ahrens text, The Secret War Against the Jews, and we're going to review some of the history of the relationship between the Bush family, their business partners, the Harrimans, and the Bushes and Harrimans' business partners, the Thyssens of the Thyssen Industrial Empire. Once again, this is from For the Record program number 186. In turn, this is from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, hard and soft cover editions, copyright St. Martin's Press, 1994.
Writing of George Herbert Walker, the man for whom our former president was named and for whom the W in George W stands for, we read as follows. Walker was one of Hitler's most powerful financial supporters in the United States. The relationship went all the way back to 1924 when Fritz Thyssen, the German industrialist, was financing Hitler's infant Nazi party. As mentioned in earlier chapters, there were American contributors as well. Some Americans were just bigots and made their connections to Germany through Alan Dulles' firm of Sullivan and Cromwell because they supported fascism. The Dulles brothers, who were in it for profit more than ideology, arranged American investments in Nazi Germany in the 1930s to ensure that their clients did well out of the German economic recovery. Quote, Dulles clearly emphasized projects for Germany and for Mussolini's fascist state. All told, these and more than a dozen similar transactions had a combined value in excess of $1 billion. Sullivan and Cromwell was not the only firm engaged in funding Germany. According to the splendid Blonde Beast, Christopher Simpson's seminal history of the politics of genocide and profit, Brown Brothers Harriman was another bank that specialized in investments in Germany. The key figure in the firm was Averell Harriman, a dominating figure in the American establishment who, for almost half a century, helped form many of Washington's major foreign policies. Some of his allies in this latter endeavor, who also served on the firm's board, included Robert Levet, who, as previously discussed, worked closely with James Forrestal to lead the State Department's revolt against Truman's pro-Zionist policy during the UN debate on the partition of Palestine, and George Bush's father, Prescott, who later became a U.S. senator. The firm originally was known as W.A. Harriman & Company. The link between Harriman & Company's American investors and Thyssen started in the 1920s through the Union Banking Corporation, which began trading in 1924. The Harriman Company and the Union Banking Corporation, two of the links between the Wall Street crowd and Fritz Thyssen, and just who the key people were in the Union Banking Corporation and Harriman, discussed here as follows by Loftus and Ahrens. In just 1 3-year period, the Harriman firm sold more than $50 million of German bonds to American investors. Bert Walker was Union Banking's president, and the firm was located in the offices of Averell Harriman's company at 39 Broadway in New York. In 1926, Bert Walker did a favor for his new son-in-law, Prescott Bush. It was the sort of favor families do to help their children make a start in life, but Prescott came to regret it bitterly. Walker made Prescott vice president of W.A. Harriman. The problem was that Walker's specialty was companies that traded with Germany. As Fritz Thyssen and the other German industrialists consolidated Hitler's political power in the 1930s, an American financial connection was needed. According to our sources, Union Banking became an out-and-out Nazi money laundering machine. As we shall see, there is substantial evidence to support this charge. Note that Harriman Company and Union Banking with Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather and the father of the president and former CIA director, being centrally involved in Union Banking and Harriman and Company, that placed them right in the middle of the financing of the fascist powers of Europe, Hitler in particular, and also placed them in direct contact with the Thyssens. Bear in mind that the genesis of that relationship took place at the same time as the genesis of the relationship between Martin Bormann and the Thyssens.
That again from For the Record Program 186, accessed in For the Record 248, and in turn borrowing once again from the text of The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Now, due to the limitations of time, I'm simply going to sum up and note a couple of other points made in the context of that same discussion. First of all, one of the things that I noted in connection with the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry and the Thyssen Empire in particular was the fact that the masking of those holdings was done by Alan Dulles, who along with his brother John Foster Dulles were major partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm. Later under the Eisenhower administration, John Foster became Secretary of State and Alan Dulles head of the CIA. One of the things that I've noted, another deadly echo coming forward from the past, the Saudi bin Laden group, which, despite disclaimers to the contrary, appears to have been implicated in the events of September 11th, the general counsel, the chief counsel for Saudi bin Laden group, is none other than Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm. I also noted, as you would have detected at the end there, the relationship between the Bormann group, the Bormann post-war flight capital organization, and the Bush family, and in particular the Hamburg America line, one of the major Bush family-connected Nazi businesses that was involved in Third Reich operations before, during, and after World War II, as part of the Bormann Flight Capital Program. One of the things that I noted in the context of some of our discussions with Daniel Hopsicker, specifically in For the Records 482, 483, and 484, was that Mohammed Atta in Florida was associating not only with primarily with Germans, Austrian, and Swiss, so-called Schweizerdeutsch, Swiss of German origin, but that many of Mohammed Atta's associates in Florida, hijacker Mohammed Atta's associates in Florida, were the sons and daughters of prominent German industrialists, and that strongly suggests a Bormann echo. I would note that Mohammed Atta's travels in Germany and perhaps in the United States were conducted under the auspices of the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft. Karl Duisberg being the head of Bayer, part of IG Farben, and the IG Farben complex very close to the Bormann group. So again, some deadly echoes coming from the past to the present. And indeed, on September 11th, 2001, we had a very direct Hamburg to America line. Hamburg, of course, was the location of the cell that was at the core of the events of September 11th. One of the things I noted, too, in For the Record 248, was that the elder George Bush played a primary role in making permanent the Nazi emigre milieu that had become an integral part of the Republican Party during presidential election years. These Nazi and fascist collaborators, Ukrainian fascists, Baltic fascists, Romanian Iron Guard, Croatian Ustashi, Bulgarian National Front, Hungarian Arrow Cross, they had been brought into the U.S. at the end of World War II under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom, devised by Alan Dulles, overseen by Richard Nixon, fronted for by Ronald Reagan, and executed by William Casey, and that these Nazi emigre elements became a key part of the Republican Party. And we're going to review that, and then we're going to update that at the end. This also comes from The Secret War Against the Jews, and also comes from For the Record program number 186. What we're going to look at now is George Bush's post-World War II involvement with the Nazi emigre milieu that we've looked at in the past. This milieu was heavily overlapped with the Reinhard Gehlen Eastern Front Nazi spy outfit that jumped to the CIA, and also with organizations like the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, basically a renaming of Hitler's Committee of Subjugated Nations from 1943, a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascist groups allied with Nazi Germany. These same Nazi emigres, or fascist freedom fighters, as John Loftus and Mark Ahrens termed them, were involved in the Crusade for Freedom, in which many of these people, war criminals, some of them of the First Order, were brought into the United States to serve as leaders in our Eastern European ethnic communities. This project was the godchild of Alan Dulles, who helped to mask the Nazi assets. It was run for Dulles by Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson for this project was Ronald Reagan, and the person who handled the State Department machinations to bring them into the United States was William Casey, who then, of course, became Reagan's campaign manager later on and Reagan's CIA director. That, by the way, is discussed in For the Record segments 29 and also For the Record 48. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, we're now going to take a look at George Bush's role in helping to bring these Nazi emigre into the Republican Party in a formal way. They coalesced as the Republican Ethnic Heritage Organization and became a formal and very important element of the Republican Party, literally a Nazi wing of the Republican Party with its roots firmly planted in the Third Reich. Note also the closeness between the Bush family and the Nixons. Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, was very close to Nixon and reputedly recruited Nixon to be vice president under Eisenhower, and George Bush in his biography describes Richard Nixon as his mentor.
of the relationship between George Bush and Richard Nixon, and George Bush's shepherding of this Nazi milieu into its formal inclusion as a permanent part of the Republican Party, we read as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews. The most intriguing of Bush's early connections was to Richard Nixon, who as vice president had supervised Allen Dulles' covert planning for the Bay of Pigs. For years it had been rumored that Dulles' client, George Bush's father, was one of the Republican leaders who recruited Nixon to run for Congress, and later convinced Eisenhower to take him on as vice president. There is no doubt that the two families were close. George Bush described Nixon as his mentor, unquote. Nixon was a Bush supporter in his very first tilt at politics during his unsuccessful run for the Senate in 1964, and turned out again when he entered the House 2 years later, skipping down. So in 1972, Richard Nixon appointed George Bush as head of the Republican National Committee. It was George Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. Laszlo Pastor, a Hungarian fascist and a member of the Arrow Cross organization, allied with Hitler. More about this formal coalescing of this Nazi milieu into a key wing of the Republican Party. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. It seems clear that George Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these, quote, ethnics, unquote, really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to the fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. And skipping down. When taken in conjunction with the earlier Australian report and the Washington Post revelation that Nazis were being used for U.S. campaign purposes, the Republican memo confirming Bush's, quote, full knowledge, unquote, of the ethnic campaign looks like a smoking gun as far as Bush's personal complicity is concerned. Nearly 20 years later, and after exposés in several respectable newspapers, George Bush continued to recruit most of the same ethnic fascists, including Laszlo Pastor, for his own 1988 ethnic outreach program when he first ran for president. According to a number of our sources in the intelligence community, it was Bush who told Nixon that the Watergate investigations might start uncovering the fascist skeletons in the Republican Party's closet. Bush himself acknowledges that he wrote Nixon a letter asking him to step down. The day after Bush did so, Nixon resigned. That again from For the Record program number 186.
Among the fascist collaborationist groups that were employed by elements of U.S. intelligence at the end of World War II was the Muslim Brotherhood, which collaborated with the Third Reich and ultimately yielded the Afghan Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda. As we looked at in For the Record 356 and 357, the Muslim Brotherhood elements were also grafted on to the Republican Party's ethnic branch by Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, and for the same reasons that the Nazi emigre were originally brought in, namely to counteract the Jewish vote. And on March 20th, 2002, the Operation Green Quest raids revealed the extent of the relationship between the GOP, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Al-Taqwa milieu, and Al-Qaeda. Once again, a deadly echo of the past. And I want to stress that this is not an exercise in self-righteousness or egotism, but rather it is to point out that understanding deep politics can yield an understanding of what is going to be taking place in the future. This concludes For the Record program number 510, Deadly Echoes, I Told You So, Part 2, being recorded on May 8th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.